Back with Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary.
That's right.
Yes, that is right.
It's Marooned on Mars, and I'm Hillary.
And I'm Matt. And it's somehow weirder this week, the second week that we're recording it remotely.
Yeah.
It wasn't weird until we started recording, and now I'm more awkward doing the introduction. Yeah. But
the recording is weird. It definitely feel like way more mediated. It's much more mediated.
Yeah, there's a barrier that
down in person.
Exactly, there's a barrier that we punch through as soon as I say hello.
Yeah,
that suddenly we're not talking like we normally talk anymore. Now we're like hosting a show.
Yeah,
that's silly.
What is this show about?
Why? Oh, this is for all of our new fans tuning in. Just what is this
Someone new might be listening.
Yeah, but they'll probably start with the introduction. Our introduction has by far the most number of listens.
Things drop off steeply after that.
Pretty steeply, not that steeply. Not as steeply as you would think, actually. This is our Kim Stanley Robinson read-along podcast, where we read reading the works of Kim Stanley Robinson. We started with the Mars trilogy, and now we're in The Martians, which is like the apocrypha of the Mars trilogy.
Yeah,
these are stories that sort of didn't happen, but might have happened. Alternate histories, same characters, same kind of basic principles, but what if things had taken a different turn? Or there's a pocket of a story inside the story, the real story of the trilogy, like we did last week with Maya and Desmond, that sort of happened, but it was sort of in the background and no one knew about it. But now we know about it, and it's fun to think about and talk about.
Yeah.
And that's what literature is all about, having fun.
It's good times, just good times. These stories are amazing. And I think the book is really... It's fascinating to me as a book. I feel like it really is kind of a whole thing. You know, it's not just sort of a series of short stories that are in one way or another related to the Mars trilogy. I think the book itself has a kind of shape, and it has all of these interesting, like, repeated kind of thematic interests that are there in the Mars books, but don't, but feel also specific to the Martians, which I think is really cool.
For sure. Like, they're given a completely different flavor because they're, like, freed from the kind of overarching narrative plot thrust of the trilogy. So they're free to kind of do what they want to do. But they have, like, a complete... And they're much, much shorter, these chapters and stories and parts.
Yeah.
Are much, much, much shorter. So they can have... They have this, like... they have this sense of, like... of freedom, but then also are tied to the original stories and give you a really different perspective on them. And it's really a rich, really, really rich collection in the context of the other books.
I agree. I mean, I'm really, really enjoying reading it. I was actually thinking about, because I hurt my foot like a month ago. I have tendonitis or something on my foot, so I haven't been able to walk. And I was just on vacation in Rhode Island, in a place where a lot of what I do there is like going on little hikes. Mm. So not walking felt very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And then it also made me realize how much I like constitute myself by doing things. And that was kind of a, you know, useful / depressing revelation. But anyway, it made me think about one of the stories that we talked about, I think last time, the Four Teleological Trails story, which is, is a funny mix of like story and sort of reflection in ways it has an almost essayistic quality. Mm-hmm. But, you know, part of what it's about is about like walking, like, hiking, finding a trail, walking from place to place, getting through part of a walk that's like difficult and dangerous. And I was thinking, like, this is such a great, like, what a great mode of science fiction. Like, to write science fiction about hiking is just like such an amazing
Yeah, that's
idea.
interesting.
I feel like that's like the most, I think I've said this in like when we were talking about the Mars trilogy, but something I really love about Stan's work is he just cares so much about the place of everyday things and
We
like
talk about
regular
this a
life
lot.
experience. And I feel like something about like the kind of what it takes to think that like you would, that there is a science fiction story that's about hiking, like is all about, really like thinking that quotidian or regular experience like really, really matters,
I mean,
and yeah, go ahead.
it goes along with the notion that, like, life only exists in these, like, 4 kilometers of crust on top of this otherwise completely dead rock, and that in itself is a total marvel and almost science fictional, like how unique and weird it is that we even have this, so that therefore it follows from that literally everything is super weird and unique, and we should really pay attention to it and cherish it.
And at the same time, we just get absorbed in the routines of daily life and like don't
So
notice them, right?
boring. Walking is so boring. Can't we invent some wheeled gizmo to like prevent us from walking? Ugh.
Oh, flying cars.
Flying cars. Somebody on Twitter or
Oh,
Facebook
regular cars.
are which?
I just said regular
Or
cars.
regular cars, or those what is it called? The thing that Job drives in Arrested Development and that like a lot of cops ride, those stand-up wheeled things. The Segways. And there's Segways tours all over Chicago too. It's just like, good Lord. Jesus.
Oh, and the scooters.
What a
The
nightmare. Oh, the
scooters.
scooters are now the thing in Chicago, right? They're
Oh my God. They're just like lying, like the scooter corpses litter the sidewalks
There's this
everywhere.
like fr is it a free scooter program or a scooter checkout program like a
Oh,
like the Divvy
it's not
bike?
free.
It's not free
It's
for
like,
sure.
yeah, it works like the way that like Divvy bikes work. But rather than, the Divvy bikes you return to like a stand, but the scooters you don't have to return anywhere. So, you basically you open them with an app and then you scoot dangerously down the street,
And
and then you
they're electrically motored, right? Like,
yeah, they're electric.
Jesus.
And for some reason, the whole thing is marketed as one as public transportation, which is obviously just bullshit because, like, it's a fairly small segment of the population for whom a scooter could be useful. And, like, most people are just, like, riding them. I've actually seen people, like, riding them carrying multiple bags of groceries, which is just terrifying to watch. But it's not public transportation. That's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, and also they're owned by private companies. It's like one of them is like owned by Lyft and one is owned by Uber or whatever. And then like six other private companies. What was I saying? Oh, and then the other thing they're marketed as is as environmentally friendly. But of course, like they have to get recharged someplace. And maybe like the battery is like a highly efficient battery. But because people can just leave them anywhere, you also have to have like a fleet of vans that are driving around the city, finding the scooters, picking them up, driving them to the place where they get charged. Anyway.
And then not only are pedestrians getting hit by these scooters because they're just whizzing around so fast with no noise at all, totally silently, but then when they're not in use, you trip over them on the sidewalk and break your neck and die.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you're supposed to ride them in the street.
Oh, God.
So most people do ride them in the street, but like they don't have helmets
That's
on. I mean, I
terrifying.
just, yeah, it's not good. It's not good.
That's terrifying. I was going to say that on Facebook, somebody mentioned that teleological trails was one of their favorite stories, and I was hoping that we did it justice, and I can't remember if we did or not, but to whoever that was, I hope you're not upset with how we may have or may or may not have botched our discussion of 4 teleological trails.
It's an amazing story.
And the other thing I wanted to mention was that somebody else pointed this out, and I discovered it, but I didn't bring it up with you, is that if you look at in the front cover, the kind of publication information, Exploring Fossil Canyon was actually first published in 1982. So yeah. Long before the Mars trilogy was even begun or was published, certainly. And then the Green Mars was published a few years after that. So
right.
That the next episode we'll do, we will be on Green Mars, and it'll pick up the story of the people that we saw in Exploring Fossil Canyon. So that's really interesting and neat as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so that's another way that you could think about the book, because of course, like the stories have like varying kinds of like temporal relations to the novels. Yeah. Some of them fit in with the novels. Some of them offer an alternate, and some of them are in like an adjacent, but probably different timeline or world line or whatever it is. But also, yeah, the stuff in the book is written at different times too, and then put together. So like another way to think about it, I guess, would be like, you know, the actual like composition or first publication of the stories in relation to the Mars trilogy. I think that could be interesting. I feel like somebody asked us on Twitter, said that they didn't have the
Michael.
Discovering Life story. Was that right?
Yeah.
And at least in my book, it says that story is copyright 2000. So it may have there may be an earlier edition of The Martians that doesn't have that story in it.
Yeah, copyright 1999. The whole thing is copyright 1999. So as a collection, Martians came out in 99. And then the year after that, it looks like a new edition was published with Discovering Life. So for our friend Michael on Twitter, that's the answer to that question, that Discovering Life was at. You've got an old edition of the an original edition of the book, and you need to go buy a new one from somewhere that's not Amazon, so you can read Discovering Life.
Your favorite independent bookseller.
Your favorite independent bookseller. Okay. So with no further ado.
All right, so we're talking about Coyote Makes Trouble, and we're talking about Michelle and Provence.
Yes,
right?
Those are the two. That is correct. And these are both super short. In preparation for our super long episode on Green Mars next week. These are really, fun little sort of Coyote Makes Trouble happens within the span of like just a few hours, it seems like.
Yeah.
Like half a day.
Yeah.
Where he is sort of leading the kind of underground resistance and the kind of spy network of Burroughs. At some point inside the plot of the Mars trilogy.
Right.
So it's after Sax has been sort of rescued from his torture, but I guess probably before one of the Martian revolutions, like just before the outbreak of the second one.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I think so. I don't know. Yeah. Someone else who's keeping track of the timeline can correct us on this.
I think it's before the one where they kick the UNTA off of Mars, right?
Yeah.
So it's like set in the moment where, like, you know, people are planning and doing things, but action has not been taken, including the sort of extremist red factions haven't started doing anything yet. We just have the kind of specter that they might. But of course, Coyote, you know, Maya and Michelle are living above the dance studio, and Maya keeps saying, we got to wait, we got to wait. But Coyote's like not interested in waiting. He wants to make something happen.
Well, she's trying to keep everything together for the right moment, but he is just chomping at the bit to, you know, poke and prod at the power structure, at, if not, you know, crash the whole system or whatever. But he also does recognize that, you know, the Reds, I mean, Coyote occupies this really interesting spot within the revolution because he's gathering information, and he's also an agent who's trying to make things happen, but then he's also got his own ideas about how things should go and how things shouldn't go. So the Reds want to go, you know, accelerate things way more, and he's not altogether crazy about their plans, whatever those would be, which is like on page 133 he's telling Maya another faction wants to make something go wrong with the deep thermal bomb, sabotage one of those nukes in such a way that the radiation reaches the surface, get the whole operation shut down. Radiation on the surface, it's insane. Coyote had to agree, though he liked their attitude anyhow. So he just wants to do something. He's hemmed in.
Right. And this story really fits into one of the major sort of like strains of like thinking about politics and thinking about change in the Mars trilogy, which is, you know, sort of putting action against strategy, right? Thinking about what the relationship is between like violence and tactics, right? Thinking about like the relationship between, you know, like a small demonstration and a large scale revelation of power, like how it is that you take power. I mean, this is, you know, this is a whole, I mean, a little short story that is about doing a banner drop. I mean, it's about doing a, you know, it's about doing a form of action that like, you know, we still do, you know, and that require that, you know, like, I mean, I feel like when you are like, I don't know, like driving along a highway and you see a banner dropped from a bridge over a highway, or when you're like downtown and you see a banner dropped down the side of a building or something like that, like, you know, you just see that as like this like moment of like, oh, you know, either cool or you're like annoyed because it's like, you know, whatever. You just see that as a moment, but like actually like to do that requires not only a certain amount of courage, but like a lot of technical planning, you know, like those big banners that get dropped down, like are heavy. And it's not only that you have to make it, but you have to figure out how you can hang it there. So it's not going to like bend and then like fall down on people. And so that it's legible and all that kind of thing. I just like, you know, and in some ways, like that is what this story is about. It's like Coyote, like, has this plan for doing a banner drop, and the plan gets fucked up the first time. So he's like, I've got an even better idea.
Well, I like it that he has these two women who, I don't know what their deal is, if they're like, you know, college co-eds or if they're like,
they like come off as college
part co-eds. Of, but they could be like part of the Manson family or something, who knows. But one of them he's already suspicious of and like seems to potentially maybe have betrayed him or be a double agent or something. But yeah, and then he's got his own plan, his own contingency plan that no one else knows about beyond that. And of course, what's cool is that, as you were saying, like the banner drops are technically very difficult. As technology has developed in the future on Mars, so too has the technology for doing banner drops. So it's light enough where he can carry it by himself. Just, I mean, I think one of the girls sort of hands holds it out to him. It's just in the palm of her hand. It's that small. And then he also, but he's able to do it by himself, just climbing a rock face, putting an Ariadne thread through a bolt and then going down and then across the street with the Ariadne thread. I just can't imagine the logistics of making sure no one trips over it or like whatever.
Yeah, that part is so great.
Seems suspicious, but it all works out. And so, and then, and of course it's all directed at his nemesis, Hastings. At some point, where does it say that? Hastings is brought up and he goes, Hastings. And he says, Hastings, his nemesis, which is so much fun to reread the Mars trilogy, thinking about Coyote as being, you know, as Hastings as being Coyote's nemesis, as this force. These two people never meet, right? But that Coyote has directed his energy. Not only does he have a revolutionary energy, but it's also directed at this individual Hastings, who he regards as his nemesis. It's on 132.
I mean, and the sort of like the, I mean, part of the delight of Coyote is that he, like you were saying before, he both is, you know, he wants the revolution, but he's also like, his principles, which seem to be largely, you know, anarchist principles, don't align well with, you know, being in alignment with others. So he both like is working towards something that other people are working toward, and also is kind of like interested in like making something happen that, you know, there aren't that many other people who seem to want to make happen, which does seem to be like, you know, actually getting rid of government, actually like, you know, producing a different sort of transformation, not the peaceful transition to some other kind of power. I love. I love the very opening of the story on 131, The city was beautiful at night, tent invisible. It seemed they lived under the stars, and the stars seemed to have fallen into the city as well, lining the sides of the nine mesas so that walking the streets, it appeared one sailed in a fleet of immense luxury liners, as during one well-remembered evening in his childhood, when suddenly four great white ships had appeared in Port of Spain's outer harbor, each an entire sparkling world, like galaxies come down to anchor in their harbor. Which I think is a really beautiful opening, and it does a thing that I think is like, I love how you, that passage moves from like sounding like it is, you know, just like a kind of moment of narrative description into one that is specified by, you know, like this is the description a particular person mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. that is Coyote, and the kind of link between, I mean, first of all, I think the sort of just like over and over again in the Mars books and then in these stories as well, you get these like re-glimpses of where you are,
right.
you know, and also you see these places, you know, the development of these big cities as, you know, extraordinarily beautiful, mm-hmm. you know, like, but the sort of comparison to like being a child, you know, in Trinidad and like seeing like the cruise ships parked there,
right,
and
yeah.
they are sort of like beauty, but presumably also like some sense of like, you know, the way in which like the cruise ships represent a like, you know, ongoing like colonial relation to the place that you're from, you know, just like such a great, like, both like really evocative and beautiful first paragraph, and also like has this kind of very interesting like way of setting up like, you know, why would Coyote be somebody who is intent on like dismantling power in any way that he can?
Yeah, I mean, the I like that a lot. The other note about the these luxury liners is that if you've ever been in a, like, I remember being in Italy and seeing the luxury liners near Venice. And they're so immense. If you've never seen one in person, you can't imagine how big they are. And that must be a very science fictional experience,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Like Stan was talking about in her, yeah, interview, how, you know, the orange groves in Orange County being torn up 5 acres at 5 acres a day. We could, like, the deforestation, the Amazon, just the very presence of these luxury liners that are as big as the biggest building you've ever seen in your life. If you're from,
yeah,
Port of Spain, or even if you live in Venice or whatever, they're so unimaginably big that it's for me, definitely it triggered like, oh, that's not good. I don't like,
yeah,
that.
Right. And it's also another, I feel like one of the sort of patterns I've been noticing through these stories is kind of repeated returns to both like specific references to, but also images of like little worlds, like,
yeah,
little worlds within larger worlds, or like the division of our world into multiple little worlds, which I think, you know, and we talked about this last time in the last time, right, when we were talking about Maya and Desmond, mm, the sense of like that is both about partitioning life, you, mm, know, confinement, but also like a way in which like you come to know a kind of place around you, that sort of image of the little world. And then here we get this like, you know, those like luxury liners are like the size of a world, and they are self-contained,
yeah,
right? You know, like everybody who comes into that, you know, like whatever Caribbean port on their cruise ship,
right,
is going to, you know, walk around, take a tour on the island, but like they're, everything else is contained on the cruise ship.
Yeah.
Right? I think that those, there's like, that's one of the kind of like that, and the sort of like thinking about like trails and climbing and walking seem to me to be like threads that are running through, mm-hmm, all of these stories in a way that I like a lot. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. And then the last thing, so the other thing that I really, the final part of the, like the end of the story where, so the original, Banner had read, "The true transition has not yet begun," like a clever like play on words. And Coyote's is a little bit more direct. UNTA, we are going to kick your ass off Mars. And which is, I think, more effective and better and funnier. And that's kind of the point. He laughed at the thought. It would be in the air less than 10 minutes, he figured. But photos would be taken. Some would laugh, others scowl. Maya would be irritated with him, he knew. But it was a war of nerves at this point, and UNTA needed to know that the majority of the population was against them. This, in Coyote's opinion, was extremely important. Also important to have the laughter on your side. He would argue strategy with her if he had to. We'll laugh them right off the planet, he said to her in his mind angrily, and laughed at the thought. Dawn was lightening the sky to the east. Later that day, he would have to get out of town. But first, a good breakfast, maybe even a champagne breakfast, down by the canal before the train came in. It wasn't every day that you got to announce a revolution. I wanted to think about that role of laughter playing in the revolution, because I don't know. It seems to me definitely necessary to have a revolution that also includes laughter, and to revolutionize laughter at the same time that you're revolutionizing everything else. Mm-hmm. But I also want to, like, is that like a historical moment? Like, the revolutions that are happening right now, the kind of revolts and things, the idea that, like, oh, that Donald Trump would be good for comedy is questionable. At least official comedy, right? Like Saturday Night Live has never been worse, and that's saying a lot. I don't watch it, so I don't know. But like, it also seems to me that, like, just on a superficial level, looking at the kind of upheavals and rebellions, Extinction Rebellion, for instance, I don't see a lot of humor there, or laughter. I think a revolution has to be joyful, and I don't know that this is what's happening yet has yet attained to the quality of like a joyful revolution. It feels very serious to me. Like, I was thinking about Greta Thunberg, who just arrived in New York, and, you know, she's young and she's very earnest. And she also has like a kind of glint in her eye sometimes. Like, she has a smirk in her, you know, smile, but she's not funny. Like, I don't know if it's, no. There's a lot of laughter involved in what she's doing. So I was just kind of thinking about that kind of relationship that we see that's sort of available in the Mars trilogy with Coyote versus like what we're confronting today. I don't know if you have an opinion about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, I do think, like, you know, something like Extinction Rebellion is a good example of a movement whose tactics certainly, like, because they do a lot of stuff that's like performative, and they do like performance. Mm-hmm. Probably not performative is probably the wrong way to put it. And, you know, their tactics include like, costume and like extremity of various kinds, right? I think that there's an element of like playfulness being brought to bear, right? You know, in the sort of the way in which they're trying to constitute like spectacles to make people pay attention. But I also think, like, even in the Mars books, like, there's not a lot of humor around the revolutions, you know, like, if we think about, like, I think the idea of, like, bringing people together, like, through, like, laughter or joy, like, I agree. I think that seems, like, really important. But also, like, under circumstances of extremity, like, just extreme, you know, like, difficult. Like, I mean, one of the things in this chapter that we're reminded of, because Coyote is at least spending part of his time, like, working as a laborer, is how, like, there are basically, like, you know, these, like, tent cities of, like, laborers, like, outside of boroughs, like, just, you know, packed in together, given very few resources, you know, like the sort of like the like the situation is bad, you know, and like in some ways, like, Coyote's willingness to be, I mean, I guess there's always this sort of question about, like, you know, probably not that there aren't circumstances, probably not like that there are circumstances in which one couldn't find anything funny. But sometimes, like, the, you know, what's driving you to be willing to, like, do what it takes to make large scale change is like a sense of, like, exhaustion,
Yeah.
right? And exigency that is so great, right?
Yeah.
But I do think like that is, I mean, that is one of the things that Coyote is in this book and also in the other books that he does and he brings is, you know, he both brings that kind of like, he brings an element of, I mean, first of all, I think he brings a sort of like bears with him as a character in what his in his background. He brings a different sort of set of like historical experiences,
Right,
right? He's
right.
a person who is from a different place than everybody else, right? He brings this kind of outsiderness, but his coyote part is also that like is that trickster part too, you know, the person
Right.
who would like not only like delight in climbing up one mesa to put a like ring, you know, drill a ring into the ground and tie the thread to it, and then have to run across a whole bunch of dark streets and climb all the way up, you know, who would like delight in action, who would delight in like fucking with people, you know, who would like want to take pleasure in a moment, and I think that that's like that seems to be, I don't know, maybe we should be thinking like in a like either a multiple way or like a dialectical way, right? That's a that is one principle that kind of like needs to be in play,
Right,
right?
yeah,
Right.
yeah.
But it also but I mean that's also a reason that like this story is here too, right? Because the last time we saw Coyote in the Maya Desmond story, that's like a much more like serious, you
Yeah,
know, that's a
that.
version of Coyote where he's like the comforter and he's
Right.
like, you know, we've all been through a lot and we're sad, but we can take care of each other also, you
That's what I
know.
was gonna. That's what I was gonna say. I just totally had a total brain fart. But that this is a Coyote chapter rather than a Desmond
Yeah, rather
chapter,
than Desmond. Yeah,
right?
yeah.
So he's able
Right.
to
So it's also a
inhabit.
persona. Yeah.
It's able to inhabit that persona, right? Which and that itself is kind of a mask, which is a kind of form of play.
I just want to say one more thing about this story, just
Yes.
one more moment from it that was really striking to me, which is the on 135, which is when they're first, so they're first going up to start on the first time they try to do the banner drop when he's with the two women and they get busted and they have to run. So they're climbing up Ellis Butte.
Yeah.
Ellis Butte was steep, but he'd long ago memorized the footpath, beaten up a ravine, cleaving in the northern wall of the mesa. Burroughs's nine mesas had become stupendous buildings, and in people's minds, they were nothing more than that, like a
Right.
convocation of massive cathedrals, so that climbing them was now like climbing the side of a building and seldom done anymore. But every one of the mesas still had the old footpath draping its sides if you knew where to find them. And Coyote had his roots on every side of all nine of them. And then you get to see that in action, like as he's like escaping from the cops,
Yeah.
you know, John Cartering his way like
Yeah.
down the side of the mesa or whatever. But I just like, I love that image. Like, first of all, we get that sort of like crazy thought of like these like giant mesas made into like gigantic like you know buildings that seem to be like glamorous where people are having like nice apartments and fancy parties, but that there are still the old footpaths up them and the like sort of is it a mesa or is it a building, and if you remember that it's a mesa you can still climb up it,
That's
right?
right.
You
Yeah.
know.
Yeah. So like a completely different way of looking at the world that enables a different set of actions and
Yeah,
possibilities.
exactly. And I feel like that ties really nicely into the sort of like four teleological trails question about like, was this a trail that somebody made? Is it a
Yeah.
path? Is this just the best way to get across something?
Yeah.
Or do you just think that this is the best way because another person did it before you,
Yeah,
right? You know,
totally.
yeah.
Let's take a brief break,
All right.
and then we'll be back with Michelle in Provence. Okay, we're back.
All right. Hey.
We have to take these breaks now because we have to record these in chunks since we're doing it remote style. And so maybe I'll add commercials in the in between for like
Yeah.
material
Do you think
goods.
for mattresses or something?
Yeah. Exactly. You can only make any money if your recordings get 1,000 plays. So we're not quite there yet.
Oh, but the but after that.
We need about 800 more listeners. Then we can make $15 per episode. No, but it's good. Okay, Michelle in Provence. This is a really lovely chapter. And you were saying it's very melancholy, and I agree, but I also think it's very sweet and hopeful in a weird way.
Yeah. Yeah, I also think it's a lovely chapter. And it, I mean, it is kind of, I guess, a chapter about like hope in the sort of Michelle fashion
Well,
of
yeah,
hope is
exactly.
always kind of hanging on to an
You have to
idea.
calibrate when you're reading a Michelle chapter, you have to calibrate everything through Michelle, who's just this depressed mess of a human being, so that like any kind of like glimmer of hope is automatically like a lot of hope in
Yeah, right.
in the context of who Michelle is.
So this chapter pick this story picks up directly from the very first story in the collection, Michelle in Antarctica. Right.
Yes.
I mean, over.
You were throwing it to me, where he basically gives a recommendation: we shouldn't go to Mars because it's just not going to work. And then he gives his recommendation like, let's not do it. It'll never work. People go crazy. It'll be bad. And then the committee or whatever goes, okay, we agree. We're not going to go to Mars. And then he like sleeps on it. And he goes back and he goes, no, we should really go. We should really go. And they're like, no, we're not going to go anyway. And so they don't send the first 100. What they do instead is it basically people still go to Mars, but it's divided upon nationalistic lines. So the European Union sends up their colony, and probably the Americans and the Russians. They all do things separately, but there's no permanent space colony on Mars. They go to Mars not in permanent settlements. They go to Mars in these kind of, brief scientific missions, and all the different countries sort of have their kind of, it's like an international space station type of thing. But then he gets, so then he's he goes he himself goes to Mars for a little bit. And he doesn't like it very much because you're always indoors. Even when you're outdoors, you're in a wetsuit with helmets and backpacks, and a sealed vessel. And Michelle, like most of the others there, felt it more and more acutely as time passed. All the people at the eight scientific stations exhibited symptoms of claustrophobia, except a small minority who developed agoraphobia. Michelle collected data on all of them and recorded in particular some spectacular breakdowns and a few emergency medevacs. No, there was no doubt he had been right. Mars was not habitable over the long haul. Terraforming, while theoretically possible, was thousands of years off. In the meantime, it was a rock in space, in effect, a giant asteroid. Like all the rest of them, Michelle was overjoyed when it was time to return to the warm blue world and the open air. So completely different. It's interesting because it's like a completely different mission, or creates a completely different Martian in a way. Sending the first 100 there and saying, bye, have fun, do the thing. They create in themselves the kind of subjectivity that will thrive on Mars. Whereas starting from the conditions of you're only going to be there for a little while and then you'll come back creates the conditions of a subjectivity that says this is only temporary and it's alien and foreign and not natural and I can't wait to get home.
Exactly. I mean, I think that the people who wanted to go in order to live there are, potentially also people, I mean, also people who at least have the capacity to imagine just beginning anew, right? And even having that sort of desire to cut the tie to Earth. Whereas the sort of missions that happen in this story are, maybe with people who under other circumstances would have wanted to cut the ties with Earth, but under the circumstances that they're going, that's not how they're going. And therefore, their sort of imagination of what it means to live there is completely different. I mean, which I think is such an interesting, like this and Michelle in Antarctica is both of them constitute like, these are like alt histories to the Mars trilogy, but of a hilarious kind because, like, they forestall the books being written or whatever. And like lots of alternate histories, like they revolve around the idea that maybe a single action or a single decision like makes the difference, right? Although in both cases, like we are shown that although Michel like feels like he's the person who made the decision, and in this story he's haunted by and afraid of being revealed, That it was him who made that decision. And, Maya basically like forces it out of him. And then she's like, okay, I'm satisfied now. But despite the fact that he thinks of himself as like having exercised his intentionality in a way that like foreclosed on all these possibilities, we actually see like that there are so many different branching possibilities, right? That it really is not Michelle's decision. Just as in the first story, it was not Michelle's decision that made it happen. And in this one, right off the bit that you just read on 140, after he's had the thought about, oh, thank God we're going to be able to return from these little enclosed colonies back to the blue world, then he thinks, but had he really been right? Was Mars any different than McMurdo or even Las Vegas, a city located in an unlivable desert? And then he begins to think like maybe a permanent colony would have given humanity a kind of purpose. And we have this interesting idea in here that he begins to imagine not just that he made a decision early on, he made a decision in the past that prevented one a thing from happening, but that that decision then had ramifications like for all of humanity, and as far as he's concerned, maybe more immediately and importantly, for his relationship with Maya. He begins to imagine that you could have a Mars colony that would function as a have this symbolic value for Earth, showing that everybody could like live together or whatever. And of course, if we put that next to the Mars books, well, that's not a way of thinking about an actually existing world of actually existing people. That's not a symbol, that's actually like about people making something and changing history, not existing as a kind of like emblem of togetherness or something like that, right?
But it also goes it with that same thought. He has the thought about the other miracles of science that are being performed, which include life extension, but not the kind of life extension that not the life extension not life extension the way that it's represented in the Mars books, where you could live to be 1,000 years, life extension where decades were being tacked on to people's lives. And it's decades rather than centuries or millennia or whatever. And so it's definitely it's still life extension, but it has a completely, to my mind, it has a totally different flavor. We don't see the words "a man who could have lived 1,000 years" here. We see, a sense of decades being tacked on, like you're living extra, or that you're even the given the vertiginous logarithmic expansions of scientific knowledge, perhaps that meant they would have the time to make decades into centuries, no one could say. So those two things are still, yeah, that the life extension thing is still a kind of living idea there.
And it's so interesting because here we think about what if that life extension had begun and been developed on Earth, right? I mean, which, we see in the Mars books that it ends up on Earth, right? And becomes part of what feeds like large scale political transformations on Earth. But here we just see it like just straight up amplifying, like the divide between like the 1% and the 99%, basically, right? They added years to their lives only to have more people killed, more people to kill or to render miserable. Famines were killing off millions in the quote unquote underdeveloped world, while at the same time on the same planet, near immortals were sporting in their Xanadus, which is a really interesting, like there we have the most kind of like the least hopeful version of like what it looks like to have that kind of change take place, like that it magnifies a divide, that like it doesn't offer scope for anything other than like rich people to continue being able to like do as they will, other than for capitalists to continue reproducing their own lives,
Yeah, as long as the technology is developed in the center at in the metropole, in the heart of like imperialist capitalism, then it's going to be used to those ends. But the fact that it was developed on Mars with a completely different set of understanding of like what humans are and how they should be interacting with each other and what technology is for, that allowed it to be that created the impetus behind it being ought to be available to everybody. And then he has that thought. I love the paragraph after that. Perhaps an international village on Mars could have made it clearer to all that they were a single culture on a single world. The sufferings of any individual Martian settler would have been inconsequential in comparison to the benefits of this great lesson. The project would have justified it. They would have been like cathedral builders doing hard, life-eating, useless work in order to make something beautiful that said, "We are all one." And some of them certainly would have loved that work and the life it brought because of that very statement, that goal, the sheer act of sacrifice for others, of work for the good of later generations, so that people on Earth could look up at the night sky, look up at night and say, that too is what we are, not just the horrific headlines, but a living world in the sky, a project in history. And in the sky, there's a lot of air and sky imagery in this chapter, which is really interesting. And then I like that phrase, a project in history. I always, whenever I have the opportunity and it's apropos in a class, the word project is really interesting to me, and just the suffix ject, you know, subject, object, abject, project, like that throwing forward into history, that kind of that literal projection where you're thinking about imagining a future that's different, or imagining, you know, going backwards and forwards and extending, you know, imagining an extension of life, not just a literal extension of life, but what will be the radical future? What was the radical past? How can we change the present to make it what we want or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. And then we get, you know, so on the, you know, right after that, we get the sort of like counter version of that fantasy, which is, so Michelle goes to this conference, right, where a big transnational meeting on space habitation, and he and these other people are from the original Antarctica project are supposed to come because it's the centennial of that winter. And on 143, and Maya gets there and he's like, she's still the most beautiful woman he's ever seen. The most magnificent, not just beautiful, magnificent. It really, like, Tatiana wasn't that beautiful compared to Maya. It was the most beautiful, the most magnificent. Anyway, the conference is transformed once she's there, which is also just like, there's a funny, like, his sort of, you know, his thinking about transformation always returns to like being transformed by, like, you know, the nearer stars in his sky.
Yeah,
like,
right. Maya.
But, Michelle watched the people there freshly, most much younger than he and Maya, eager to get out into space, to live on the moon, on Mars, the Jovian moons, everywhere, anywhere but Earth. The escapism inherent in their desire was obvious to Michelle, but he ignored it, tried to see it their way, tried to temper his statements and responses to match their desire. Without desire, who could live? Mars for these people was not a place, not even a destination, but a lens through which to focus their lives. And I think that, you know, in some ways, like, the important thing is to think about Michelle's idea that you could have the colony on Mars and it would be like an emblem for humanity that would remind us that we're a living world. Like, I think that is a version of thinking about that desire that does slide too easily into like, what do I want? I want to, you know, like, explore the Jovian moons because this gives me a project, and that project is just an escapism, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to like a, you know, he wants it to be this kind of, he wants to think like, oh, there could have been this transformative possibility. But the version that he has of that, like, you know, I think looks a lot like, you know, also doesn't think that Mars would then also be a living world, right? It still just imagines it can be a thing that we look up at in the night sky, right? And like, you know, and thus remember that we're all one people or whatever. I mean, and in that way, like, you know, we might be as suspicious of that as of like thinking that like the people who died building fucking Gothic cathedrals,
right,
like, you know, felt like they were part of like a big project for all humankind.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, at the same time, like, I agree with you about project, and like, there is something that's like beautiful about that. And then also in this chapter, I think like hilarious in the like very like typical of like sessions focused through Michelle, like sliding between like these like large scale like desires to make things better, and then like his own like involvement in his, you know, his version of his own life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, when I read that part of Mars for these people is not a place, not even a destination, but a lens through which to focus their lives, I couldn't help but think of California, from the mentality of like someone after World War II in the East Coast or the Midwest who thinks if I can only get, you know, it's an ideology that's constantly reiterated in especially Westerns and movies where we're going to move to California. It's going to be, you know, everything's going to be better there, you know, and then, you know, they ruined it.
Right. It's a frontier.
It's a frontier. Right? Yeah, it's a frontier. Yeah. So they kind of so they have this conference and someone from the audience asked if they thought the original Russian-American plan to send 100 permanent colonists might have been, in retrospect, the best way to go. From down the line of speakers, Maya leaned forward to look at him. Apparently, he was the obvious one to answer. He leaned toward his mic. Anything can happen in any situation. A Mars colony in the 2020s might have become all that we hoped for it, but... He shook his head, not knowing how to continue. But I lost my nerve. I lost in love. I lost all hope. But the odds were against it. Conditions would have been too hard to endure after the long haul. The 100 would have been condemned to freedom, Maya said to her mic. So there's still this, all his worst fears are being realized, right? Like, oh crap, I'm the one who did it. Now I'm going to be outed. It's my fault. But he comes back, freedom, yes, but freedom in a box, in a jail, on a rock world without an atmosphere. Physically, it would have been too hard. Life in a box is life in a prison, even if it's a prison of one's own design. We would have gone mad. Many who go there come back damaged for life. They exhibit symptoms of a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's this this back and forth where he says, what if is never a question with an answer. Now we should look at the current situation. We have moved incrementally on Mars, taken things in their proper sequence. The infrastructure is now there in place to start making it an easier place to live. Perhaps now is the time for permanent settlers. This incrementalism just doesn't seem like the way to go, Hillary. I think they should have. I liked it when they sent the 100 people there.
I was just thinking that there's this really interesting, like, I don't know quite how to describe this effect, but so here we're in the, so here we're in this, like, you know, all right, we're on this little historical timeline that's an alternate to what actually, to what happens in the Mars books, right? So what if that hadn't ever happened? Like, what would it look like? But then, so then after the conference, you know, where Michelle feels that, you know, he stumbles around and answering this question in essentially multiple different ways. He heads out with Maya and Maya's like, oh, it's just the past. And then he feels like, okay, everything's going to be fine. Although, of course, really in some ways, Maya is waiting for him to admit that, like, you know, he didn't think that they could actually have gone in the first place. But then they, as he's like taking her around Provence and showing her things, that scene, so on 146 particularly, they go swimming, they have sex, he's like extremely happy. As he's showing her around, that scene repeats almost exactly the things that they do
right
when they go to Provence in the Mars trilogy, when they go back to Earth, right? Yeah. Because he shows her the Pont de Garde, and they talk about like the beauty of the aqueduct, right? And she says Nadi would have liked it, right? Yeah, which is exactly what happens. And then they sit at a sidewalk cafe in Avignon and Michelle sips cassis and watches her relax into her metal chair like a cat, which I think is exactly what happens in those. So it's like such a, like, for the reader of both of these things, it's this very uncanny, like, if Michelle is in this position where he feels like he did something that made something happen, and now he has this kind of like problem of like the what if, like, I feel like this also really puts the reader into a very strange what if kind of space, because suddenly, like, so is there just like, they've basically like lived out almost their entire lives on Earth, and they're, you know, he's showing her around Provence and they're seeing things and enjoying them, and she's having reactions to what she sees that are this, and that scene is the same as when they return to Earth after having lived for an extended period of time on Mars, having become Martian and returned to Earth. Are those different? Are they the same? You know what I mean? Like, I think there's just something that's like really interesting there.
But they're still the same people. Like the
same people.
It's making a claim that like, that you're the same no matter what happens to you, or like the patterns are sort of built in after, you know, certainly after a certain amount of time, and that if you're put in the, in whatever situation you're in, you're going to act sort of similarly or predictably somehow. I like the trap that she lays for him on that page above. She returned to bed, pulled back to look at him. I'm not the kind of person to pull back when the stakes get high. Me neither. Except in Antarctica, right? We could have been up there a century ago. Had you, like, she just lay, like,
yeah,
she lays this perfect trap for him. It's
she's not going to let him off
the hook. No, she's not letting him off the hook. He just, when he's most relaxed and he thought he had, like, gotten past it, she sinks the claws in. It was great.
And then on 148, we get the strange revision. Because I was just thinking, like, they are the same, but one thing, in certain kinds of ways, but also, like, you know, the Maya we know from the Mars books is somebody who's gotten to, like, do all of this, like, amazing kind of, like, transformative work. And this person seems like somebody who in some ways is actually, like, still just, like, very caught up in a past moment where she feels like she lost something that she really, really wanted, right? And then on 148, we get the he's basically being like, I'm sorry, but can't we just live in the present? Because this is really good. And she's like, please, you sound like John when he first landed there. She and John Boone had been a celebrity couple for a few years, several decades ago. She mentioned him briefly the day before. A shallow man, she had said. All he wants is to have fun. I mean, it's, you know, so like we get a completely different like John. I mean, one, you know, we can imagine why you might describe him that way. But also like John Boone doesn't end up being John Boone, you know,
well, I mean, like. Was Omegendorf even invented? Like, who would he be without his popping his pills all day long? I thought that it was really back on 143, when I first read this, on the very top, I underlined this. Maya had been in Mars for 6 years. During the worst of the troubles in the 2060s, she shrugged as she remembered. It was hard to enjoy it with so much bad happening down here. And I wrote in the margin, who is this? Like, she's really like thinking of, oh, I went to Mars and you know what? Everything was such a bummer back on Earth that I was really kind of hard to enjoy my trip to Mars, you know, like, who are you? Like it felt to me, it felt like a line that was very like touristy or like very kind of like, superficial, you know, selfish basically. Like she was trying to enjoy herself rather than get caught up in like the events of these horrific events of the 2060s were ruining her time, you know?
I mean, exactly. Or just, I mean, or even the idea that like the kind of, you know, that being on Mars, the relationship to Earth would still feel so close, right? Whereas like in the Mars books at some point, you know, like they do, despite the fact that they try to track what's happening on Earth, like they feel distant from it because they're so involved in the project of like making the place where they are, right? And kind of actively wanting to distance themselves from Earth.
Because if you're going to come back to Earth, then you're going to be worried about what's going on, rather than if you think of yourself as a Martian, you can have the freedom to say, I don't give a damn about Earth, right? As so many people do. So then he decides that he wants to make a life with Maya, that Maya, this is on 149, Maya looked forward. She was ready to go on making her life no matter what had happened in the past. That was one of the qualities that made him love her. She was alive to the present, living in it, and she would want a partner to be the same. So he would have to live up to that. He would have to construct a life here, now, in Provence. That was worthy of Maya's love. That would make her want to come back again and again, perhaps to stay, at least to visit, perhaps to invite him back with her to Russia, perhaps to make a life together. It was a project. So now rather than a project in history, he's just got his own project in Provence to...
Right. Spurred by the idea that if he does a certain set of things, he will convince Maya, the person who clearly is not super invested in settling down, that she wants to settle down with him.
Yeah.
And then he inherits a house.
A house falls into his lap, which is always a good thing to happen. And these two pages have a lot of the natural imagery, like the air, the rock, settling,
the elements,
right? That we, you know, that we so associate with Michel, with his the humors and all that kind of stuff, where he's a very airy person, and he's sort of settling down, coming back down to earth to try to, you know, put sand with his feet in the water, look in the open door, you know, that he's sort of trying to ground himself to bring Maya back to him somehow. It's really and sweet.
Yeah. And it is lovely too. And it's interesting because it's not, you know, here is Michel, you know, in the Mars books, when he goes to Provence, it's about like, you know, intensely about like nostalgia and like the attachment to the place. He can barely get at the place because everything is so, you know, everything is so overcoded for him by this sense of like what he's lost, right? Mm-hmm. And there also, he thinks he can get it back if Maya would be willing to sort of stay with him. But here, I think by the end, the feeling is more that he is actually able to sort of experience being in this place that he loves, that is beautiful to him.
Yeah.
And then he wants Maya to want to join him in that place, right? But it feels like it feels like a different kind of attachment he's able to have. You know, he makes a decision in a way that, I mean, and I guess maybe this is why it feels to me like, you know, melancholy, because you expect Maya probably won't join him, but not sad, because it does feel like the relationship to the place is one that feels genuine. I love that line, the Martian sense of lightness began to seep back into him, as if like, you know, the like pleasure or the buoyancy or the atmosphere that is like holding him up and giving him pleasure in this place on Earth, he took from that like brief time on Mars.
Right.
Right. When he had to be wearing like the heavy space suit and with tanks on his back and like, you know, spending most of his time under like a tent or whatever it was. Right. I love that idea there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, just you know, him coming to terms with the fact that this is the place that he loves, that this is his home, and that he needs to make, you know, believe in that and own that, and just not, you know, not project himself into history, actually.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Cool. These were fun. These are so short, but like so rich. I find that like the shorter ones, we have just as much to say about, if not more than the longer ones, just because we can dive into them more.
Yeah. They're really lovely. They're also just like, I think that all of these stories have just, like they're structured really beautifully and like they, and they're like, you know, they're really, there's something very vivid about them that is just, they're super pleasurable.
Yeah. Cool. So, next week, hopefully next week,
Green Mars.
Which is the longest chunk in The Martians, and it's really fun. I've already read it. Are you almost done reading it? I'm going to reread it.
I'm not quite done. I haven't finished it yet.
But it's really good.
Yeah.
And a lot of fun. And that's it. You can email us at maroononmarspodcast@gmail.com.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can tweet at us. You can rate and review us on iTunes. You can leave us a voicemail on the anchor.fm app. No one ever does, and no one does anything. They don't email it. It's fine. You're just there to listen.
People do email us.
They do. It's true. They do. And we appreciate it very much.
And it's awesome. Yeah. I think that's incredible.
And all the other good things. Whatever. I don't know what to say. How do you end these things? I'm out of practice. It's so weird being mediated like this.
I know, and you haven't been talking to people either, so this is like...
I have only talked to my partner for like almost, other than like the clerk at CVS and the clerk at Lowe's and the clerk at the DMV, I've really only talked to my partner, and so I'm out of practice with talking to people.
Yeah.
So expect things to get better as I talked to more clerks in Maine.
That's right. Expect things to get better. It's Maroon on Mars.
That's our motto. Okay, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.